CTV.
Hi, everybody. If you asked any religious person in the world what the most powerful lust is, I guarantee you that they will say sexual lust. The whole religious world is arrayed against sexual lust. It's a false enemy Satan has created. While Satan works a greater evil in their midst. But sexual lust is not the greatest lust on earth. I'm going to tell you today what the greatest lust on earth is. And ironically, it's this lust that has overtaken the Christian religion. So they're barking up the wrong lust. They're barking up the wrong tree of lust. Because the most powerful lust, well, I'm going to lead up to it. But I want to read you a little bit, and I'll comment as I go, from my book, The Lie of Every Man's Battle. This is my refutation of a Christian book, Every Man's Battle. You've heard me talk about it before, that condemns men for being men, for noticing beautiful women, noticing God's creation. And they call it a terrible sin. And again, the condemnation through that book. I was forced to read this book at some point in my life, and I said, one of these days, I'm going to write a book against this, because it's the most condemning, most law-bringing book, most guilt-producing book I've ever read. And so, this is actually one of the most important books I've written. It'd be nice if somebody would read it. I don't know. I wrote it. That's okay. I did my job, and God will reward me for that at the dais. This is a very helpful book. Let me read you a quote. The power hold of religion turns nice people into insufferable finger pointers. The most difficult people in this world are those who think they've arrived at some plateau of moral perfection, then wonder why the rest of us can't imitate them. These kinds of people can't help looking down their noses at the poor sinners farther down the mountain. The poor sinners, us poor sinners down here, far down the mountain, they're at the top of the mountain. They've achieved this moral pinnacle. And we're the poor sinners way down at ground level. When this religious spirit runs amok, a mere looking down the nose at other people is not enough. Since God does not seem very good today at condemning lazy Christians, and oh boy, this book, the Every Man's Battle, the original book by Stephen Arterburn and Fred Stoker, I'm telling you, these guys, any man that does not learn how to bounce his eyes immediately from a beautiful woman, or to with great asceticism and feats of willpower try to eliminate every sexual thought from his mind, even from his dreams. Yes, even sexual dreams are outlawed, thought to be evil by these authors. And they're everybody who doesn't think like they do are lazy Christians. Yes, so since God doesn't seem very good today at condemning lazy Christians, those who think they are super Christians, we all know some. Boy, do we know some. They will take that duty upon themselves. Well, if God's going to have this conciliatory attitude today based on the cross, on the entire world, that they can't stand it. I've told you this many times, that misery loves company, and these moralists, these religious people, they can't stand that we are living free lives. They hate it. And since God doesn't seem too interested in damning these people, why isn't God damning these people for drinking beer or going to movies or looking at beautiful women? Well, we're going to take up the mantle. See, they don't know that God is conciliated to the world through Christ. They don't know that. No matter how many times you tell them, they can't get it. Their heads are thick. Their necks are stiff. Yeah. Kind of reminds me of Israelites. They will take that mantle upon themselves. The sinner will be punished either by snubbing, backstabbing, or where the religious spirit infects a nation or a mob, murder. Ah, yes, they will murder the free person. Religious people murdered the prophets. They murdered Christ. They murdered Paul. They murdered the apostles. They would murder you if they could. If they, like the Pharisees, were covered by some law that they thought they were enacting, if they could get away with it, they would murder you. They hate you that much. But murder is illegal. And so they will backstab you, they will snub you, they will tell lies about you. They will drag your name. They will call you a deceiver. They will call you evil. All because you to them are a lazy Christian and you cannot attain to their great feats of moral achievement. And again, yeah, this is a universal truth, but I wrote this chapter because of the diabolical religiosity that was just being hurled at people through these authors and this book, Every Man's Battle. Today, religion is a profitable business. Oh yes, you know that. Conferring power upon willing workers. These days, those who are addicted to attaining God's favor manually, that is, by human efforts, by human accolades, by humans giving each other diplomas and awards, they can officially set themselves as judges over the rest of us. Yes, because with a little work, the religious achiever can back up his or her moral assumptions by earning a robe, attaining a white collar, or starting a church. Oh, there you go. Now you have the mantle of power. It's false. You have the sheen of power. And if you have a robe, a white collar, or you've started a church, now you have an official platform from which you can condemn others. But there's more. Others can obtain more degrees than Nebuchadnezzar's oven. Yes, Master of Divinity has a particularly devastating ring to it, doesn't it? So you can gain an M.D.I.V. degree and then write books. Ho, then why your platform is sterling silver, and from that high place of religious snobbery, you can condemn anybody. There's nothing like an M.D.I.V. notation after one's name to shush the rabble into awestruck silence. Quiet! The man of God is about to speak. The Master of Divinity, the robed one, shall address us now. He's conferred with great power. Not by God, though. No, not by God. By himself. Thus, hate to tell you, authors, Arthur Burton Stoker, hate to tell you guys who wrote Every Man's Battle, sexual lust is not the most powerful lust in the world. They think it is, sexual lust. Oh, it's the ultimate evil, the ultimate. No, 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 no. That's a deception by Satan. It's a sidetrack. It's a diversion. One of my favorite television series, Hogan's Heroes, I know I've said this before, if they wanted to break somebody out of camp, out of Stalag 13, they would set a fire. They would create a diversion somewhere else in the camp and then do something on the other side of the camp. That's what Satan has done. Satan has set up the diversion of sex. And he has Christianity attacking it, attacking it, attacking it, calling it the ultimate lust. And by this means, Satan is now free to work the worst lust in the world through the administrators of the Christian religion. So sexual lust is not the most powerful lust in the world, nor the most dangerous. Neither is the lust for drink. There is a far stronger lust, ensnaring far more people and wreaking far more havoc upon the world than that which merely craves gin or G-strings. The lust of which I speak is so insidious and yet so subtle, that those under its influence claim God as their greatest ally. What a joke. At its most common level, this lust condemns. Later, it kills. Throughout, it walks upon water, or thinks it does, unaware of people drowning at its feet. On Monday through Thursday, it prays in pious tones, this lust does. On Friday, it kills God's Son. The most powerful lust in the world is religious lust. The name of this chapter is, if you haven't guessed already, religious lust. Let me define it for you, ladies and gentlemen. Religious lust is the desire to do something for God. It is the public manifestation of an inner self-righteousness. It's the desire to stand above one's fellows and say to God, look at me. Look at what I've attained. Notice how I've outperformed them. It's religious lust that made the Pharisees of Jesus' day throw out their chests and diminish others. I quote verses here. We know all of the verses. So let me go here on page 332, if you want to know, from my book, The Lie of Every Man's Battle. It's a must read for every married couple, for every single man. Our deliverance from sin cost Christ greatly. The normal spirit-filled reaction to this is peace and thanksgiving. That's what you're supposed to think. That's what you're supposed to feel when you behold Christ on the cross. Religious lust, on the other hand, condemns its victims to a false sense of responsibility, resulting in a great struggle or moral battle. These are the people who see the cross and feel this, like I said, and instead of just giving up on humanity, realizing that the cross finished humanity, instead of just feeling thankful and relieved, they hear the theme from Rocky, you know. It inspires them to not spiritual attainments, but to fleshly moral attainments. Don't know why it does this, but it does it. It's a wrong reaction to the cross, but it's epidemic. Religious lust condemns its victims to a false sense of responsibility, resulting in a great struggle or moral battle. The victims of religious lust imagine that Christ's sacrifice must be added to or improved upon, if not equaled. Since this is impossible, victims of religious lust suffer continual frustration. Boy, folks, isn't it great that we've been delivered from that? We've been delivered from continual frustration. But these people suffer it because they're trying to equal Christ's sacrifice. If you can believe that, what could be dumber? What could be more foolish? This leads to greater and greater feats of religious asceticism and suffering. Example, the Filipino Catholic zealots who have themselves literally nailed to crosses. Well, no, they cheat. Every Good Friday you have those Filipinos, they cheat. They're not nailed to crosses. If they're going to do it right. No, but instead they're tied to crosses every Good Friday. Yes, every Good Friday. Yeah, I'm not impressed. They're not beaten to within an inch of their lives before. That disappoints me. They're not taking on the sin of the world. That disappoints me. It's just all very nasty business. I'm going to quote one of the authors of this book. Hate to do it, but such an extreme exercise, speaking of the Filipino Catholic zealots, apparently has not yet occurred to Fred Stoker. Fred Stoker being one of the authors of Every Man's Battle. But does not the following passage that I'm about to read you from page 71 of Every Man's Battle walk a similar line? You might as well be a Filipino Catholic crucifying yourself on Good Friday. Listen to this. Fred Stoker. Given that Jesus is sinless, I suddenly realized that Jesus not only never touched a woman with dishonor, he never even looked at a woman in dishonor. Could I say that? Could I say that? Though what else did Jesus do that you can't do, dude? He never sinned. Can I say that? He never had an impure thought about anything or anybody. Can I say that? This is a desire to equal Jesus' sacrifice. The essence of religion, you all know this, is look what I'm doing for God. Why can't you do it? The essence of the cross, however, is, what a contrast this is, look what God has done for me. No one could have done that. People are supposed to look at the cross and say, that's the end of my flesh. There's nothing I can possibly do to please God. Religion, on the other hand, makes people overlook the cross, if you can even believe that, but they do. They completely overlook the cross and say, I must still atone for my sins. How could you possibly think that after looking at the cross? But it's epidemic. All religious people do that. Boy, it's Jesus Christ on the cross. I have to atone for my sins. Well, then you just watch the movie? Then you just watch The Passion of the Christ or Jesus of Nazareth or the greatest story ever told? Then you see that Jesus Christ was atoning for sin at the cross. But these people, all religious people of every religious stripe, they look at the cross of every Christian religious stripe. They look at the cross and they say, I must now atone for my sins. That's the greatest point of this video so far. I mean, it's been a great video so far. I'm pleased with it, but that's gold. And if it took me 18 minutes to get there, okay, I'm fine with it. I hope you are. I must now atone for my sins. Where does that come from? That's satanic. It's so illogical and irrational. It's so stupid that it takes a supernatural influence to cause someone to watch Jesus die on the cross and say, oh my God, I must atone for my sins. I must eliminate my sins. I must please God with my behavior. I must please God with my behavior. After that? Talk to Satan lately? Yeah. I believe he's running your life. I believe you're a Satan worshiper who thinks he's a Christ worshiper. I must still atone for my sins. God cannot look at me until I do what Jesus did. These authors of the book are infected with that. And any other religious book, this is just one example. I must still atone for my sins. God cannot look at me until I do what Jesus did. Further, I will outstrip my contemporaries. Oh, this is just what the Apostle Paul did. Only he wasn't Paul yet. He was Saul, the Pharisee. I will outstrip my contemporaries in this vital regard. I will measure myself against their failure. Boys, Saul did that big time. None of the sacrifices in Israel that he partook in every single Passover, every single Day of Atonement, he never got it. He never understood. I know he didn't see the crucifixion, but he never understood. That was God's means at the time for taking away sin. And he went through that whole ritual. And yet, he still felt that it wasn't enough. God's way then of atoning for sin was not enough. Saul would complete it. Saul would even perfect it. Saul would take over where God left off. And he said, I became a Pharisee of the Pharisees, and I attained a righteousness of the law far above any of my contemporaries. And that even was not good enough for the man. He then went around the world trying to make converts, and he sought to punish those who were not as good as he was. No one was more deceived on the face of the earth, but every single Christian today is a Saul. every single Christian today is a Saul. They look at the cross, they say, I need to do that. I need to prove to Jesus that I appreciate that. No, you don't need to prove to Jesus anything. You just have to be thankful, okay, Christian? Thankful. No. That's too passive. These people need, they have a religious lust. They lust for religious power, for religious influence. They lust to accomplish what Jesus accomplished, imagining that they possibly could. But that's how deceived these people are. And then they look at us, the free people. Oh, they get so angry at us. And they would murder you if they could. But they can't. Murder is illegal. They will backstab you. They will belittle you. They will disown you. They will trash your name. They will lie about you. And they will never talk to you again. That's what religious lust does. Religious lust is the most evil, diabolical, most prevalent lust on the face of the earth. Once a person believes that he or she has attained this plateau of sinlessness, like Saul thought he had, and this can only be a relative attainment, however, because they surely cannot be comparing themselves to Christ, but they are. This attitude then, it first belittles, then challenges others to join the cause. This is why Christians want you to join their cause. They want you to be as miserable as they are. They're already in the camp. And so any newcomer to the camp is automatically inferior, is automatically lesser than, and is automatically looking up to the person who has already established him or herself as a great religious influencer. That's why they love converts, because the converts look up to them. I love it when new people come to my channel, but not so that anybody can look up to me, so that people can get the truth and be free. Be free. Go away. Be free. You have your freedom now. You don't need to come back to me except to learn more about your freedom. But that's not the way it is with religious lust. Religious lust needs followers, needs to be looked up upon as wise man or wise woman on the mount. And it looks down its nose. And when it's not obeyed, hatred comes to the heart. Hatred. All these wonderful Christians hating people? The Pharisees, the epitome of religious attainment in Israel. Yet no one hated more than they did. Saul, by his own confession, outstripping his contemporaries in the law, yet seething with hatred. Not love, hatred. Because they have a warped concept of God, and they have a much too high estimation of themselves. It belittles, then challenges others to join the cause. The irony of this is that these others that they look down on, these others who have not joined the cause, who have not answered their call to come to church, why can't you come to church? Why can't you get baptized? Why can't you be like we are? The irony is that these others are, in fact, more spiritual than those belittling them. These poor sinners have successfully dodged the premier fruit of religiosity, which is pride. I want to continue this topic tomorrow because this is really important. And isn't that something that the very people look down upon as wrong, as twisted, as sinners, as undesirables. These people are actually more enlightened. Even though they have no reputation, they have no sheen of religiosity artificially imposed upon them, they have no self-righteousness whatsoever, they know they're sinners, they actually look at the cross and like, whew, that's a relief, I don't have to do that now. These people are far more spiritually advanced than the man at the seminary or at the academy that has more degrees than Nebuchadnezzar's oven. What an irony that is, which is why Peter, James, and John, even though they were unlettered and plain men, they were far superior in knowledge to the Pharisees. And even the most humble believer in Christ excelled the great Saul in spiritual understanding. Saul eventually came to realize that, but it took a very hard breaking.